Okay. So, what do you think FLTI stands for? Something with that acronym came up in Section 6.3. That's where we're at now. Today and tomorrow will be about Section 6.3. So, the F is for fundamental. And the T is for theory. And the L is for line and the I is for integrals. So. Okay. So way back in Calculus 1, right, we had the fundamental theorem of calculus. Actually, there are two of them. FTC 1, the first fundamental theorem, which says that the derivative of an integral with a varying endpoint is just equal to the integrand at that endpoint. If you undo all that fancy terminology, it just says the derivative of the integral takes you back to the function you started with. There's this little funny thing about varying the endpoint. That doesn't get used directly so often. What you use most often is the second fundamental theorem, right? That if you have an antiderivative, and you take, so maybe capital F right, has derivative equal to lowercase f or something like that, right? This is the one we use a lot, right? If we have some function and we have an antiderivative of it, right? A formula whose derivative is our original function, then we can just evaluate a definite integral by plugging in endpoints. Okay. So the fundamental theorem of line integrals is what we're at now. So it's analogous to the second fundamental theorem of calculus. Okay, so fundamental theorem of line integrals. So we're going to have an integral with endpoints, all right? So we're just going to, but now it's not going to be along the real line. We're not going to integrate from 0 to 1 or from 5 to 8 or whatever. We're going to integrate along some curved path, maybe, from some point in space or in the plane to some other point in space in the plane. Okay? But like this, there's going to be a start and an end point. And we're going to have an analog of a derivative. That analog is the gradient. Okay. So we have the gradient of some function. Okay. And this thing is a function of position, right? So it's a vector field, but it's a nice vector field because it's a gradient. And then we do our little work type integral, the kind we were doing yesterday. And what do we get? Well, I claim we just get the analog of this. Whatever the end position of the path is, minus the start position of the path, plugged into our actual function, I claim that's the answer. So if your vector field is a gradient and you're having to do work type integrals like this, then all you need to do is know what it's a gradient of and plug in the endpoints. Mm-hmm. So I'll talk about why this is true a bit later. It's not too hard to explain. But first, let me show an example of this tied in for the integral we did last time. Okay. So last time, we had what? We had this vector field capital F, which was x plus y, comma x minus y. And we considered two paths along it, right? There was path 1 plus 2 and path 3. They both had the same start points and the same end points. So we did these integrals somewhat laboriously, but we got them eventually. And they both worked out to be the same thing. They both worked out to be 44.5. Whether we took the L-shaped path that went up to 0,4 and then turned right and went to 7,4, starting from the origin, or whether we took the straight line path from the origin to 7,4. We could have done something zanier, right? We could have done some kind of crazy zigzag path that did this, right? Don't ask me to parameterize that one, but we could make up curved paths, and I claim that that crazy path, whatever it is, if I did this integral along the path there, I claim I would get this too, even without knowing the exact parameterization of that path. I claim that because I believe in this theorem. Now, okay, and I believe F here is a gradient. What do I think it's a gradient of? So tomorrow we'll talk about some of the process of figuring out, if something is a gradient, how do you figure out what's it a gradient of? That basically gets into analogs of the first fundamental theorem of calculus. So we'll deal with that tomorrow. But I'll just tell you what this is a gradient of. The simplest function I know that has this as its gradient is this. X squared, over 2, plus xy minus y squared over 2. All right, so if we take the gradient of this, so I'm thinking two-dimensional here, right? Okay. So if you take the x partial derivative of this thing, let's see, we get 2x over 2. The x partial derivative of this, well, you hold y constant, and the derivative of x with respect to x is 1, so you get 1 times y, so you get plus y, and then minus y squared over 2, but when you're holding y constant, you get nothing, so plus 0, right? And those 2's will cancel. So just x plus y plus 0, yeah, that matches. Now we take the y partial derivative. So holding x constant now is 0. Y partial derivative of this thing, okay? So holding x constant, we have a constant multiple there, and the derivative of y with respect to y is 1. So we get x times 1, so just x, minus the y derivative of y squared over 2, so minus 2y over 2, and the 2's cancel. Yeah, x minus y. Okay. I think my writing is getting a little too small. Let me write it bigger. Yeah, that's better. X partial and y partial, they both match the things here. This is the x partial of that function, this is the y partial of that function. And all I have to do now, if I believe this theorem, is just take my nice function here and plug in the endpoints, right? So let's see about that. Maybe switch these boards. Okay. So let's give this function a name. We'll call it lowercase f. That's usually what the book does. The vector field is capital F, and it's in bold print. I put an arrow because I can't do bold print on the board. If we have a scalar function, right, the output is just a number, not a vector. The book likes to use a lowercase letter. I'll follow that convention here. So we have our little function here. This guy. And now, endpoints. So we're going to have f at the end minus f at the start. Okay, so at the end we'll have 7 squared over 2 plus 7 times 4 minus 4 squared over 2. Right. And at the start we'll have nothing squared over 2 plus nothing times nothing minus nothing squared over 2. Okay, so minus a whole lot of nothing. Okay, so yeah, you can do some arithmetic. 49, 24.5 plus 28, 16 over 2 minus 8. So I claim that whatever your crazy path is, if you have the start and end points at 0, 0, and 7, 4, then this is what you should get. So calculus 1, calculus 2, you find the antiderivative, you plug in the end points. Here, you find the anti-gradient, if you will. The fancier name for it is potential function. Anyways, you find the anti-gradient, right? You find a function whose gradient is your vector field, if it exists, right? And then you plug in the endpoints. Now your endpoints can be points in space, not just points on a line. Questions or comments? So this is nice if your field is a gradient. Now, what was that test for how we could tell if a field was a gradient, at least locally? It's the cross partials test. Yeah, right. So if your field fails the cross partials test, don't even bother trying to find an anti-gradient, because it doesn't exist. But if it passes the cross partials test, then hey, go for it. And we'll talk tomorrow about some of the techniques for finding these anti-gradients, or potential functions as they're called. I mean, if we have time, we could start talking about it today. We'll see. Let's see. There are a few tricky points that I'll have to bring up. But that,
I'm written on the board.
Okay, so before I get into the tricky points, let's ask the first question, which is, why is this thing true?
Okay, so
so if you want to understand why it works, the two ingredients are the second fundamental theorem of calculus, back from calculus 1, and the chain rule that we learned involving partial derivatives. Okay, so our path is parameterized by some functions, right? Maybe we have vector r of t equal to g of t comma h of t if we're in 2D, right? Similarly, if we were in 3D, there'd be a third component, right? A k of t to give us the z, right? And remember, this is just x. It's just x comma y, right? So we're just saying x is a function of t, and y is a function of t. Anyways, t starts at a and ends at b, right? For some numbers a and b. Okay, it's supposed to be a path. A path is an oriented curve that has a start and an end. Path does whatever crazy stuff it does, and then it's done. Okay. So, now we bring in the chain rule. Okay. Okay, so we have this dot product here. Gradient f dot dr. So I want to expand out what that actually means in terms of components. I'll do the two-dimensional case. The three-dimensional and higher-dimensional cases all look the same. You just keep adding more terms. So we have a gradient, partial f, partial x, which I'll write using the fake fraction notation. And then here, the dr, by definition, is dx dt comma dy dt. Those time derivatives, which again I'm writing in the fractions of differential notation, times a dt, right? Okay, now what is that? Okay, so take the dot product and focus on, the dt is not what I'm really excited about. It's it's all the stuff we're multiplying the dt by. So I took the dot product there, and this is where I bring in the chain rule. The chain rule says that if you make one of those little diagrams, you know, you have there's f, and then it's influenced by x and x and y were in turn influenced by t. Right? So the influence of t on f goes through x and y, and so using the chain rule, this is just the derivative of f with respect to t. Okay. Okay. So that's the heart of it, right? That's where the calculus 3 part comes in. And then the rest is just calculus 1, easy stuff. Right? So, this dot product of a gradient with the little displacement differential is just the time derivative of our function that we were taking the gradient of times your little time increments. And so you integrate that. This is just an integral of a derivative. So we're integrating from t equals a to t equals b of the time derivative of f times dt. So we just do this time integral, but an integral undoes a derivative. So all we get is f at t equals b, right, minus f at t equals a. And that would be exactly f at the ending position minus f at the start position. So if you like, you can think of the dt's as canceling out, right? And you're just integrating df, a little change in f.
Although it's
a little bit delicate in terms of the actual definitions. Because usually the df dt is defined to be the derivative. And so the df without the dt denominator is defined to be the derivative times dt. So the meaning of this cancellation is a little subtle, but if you define everything right, it works out. So this, you can think of this just a little tiny change in f. And so we add up all those tiny changes in f from a to b. And it's just like the fundamental theorem of calculus. If you wanted, you could, of course, write this all out, right? Because if you have these functions g and h, what are we really doing here? What we're doing is we have f as a function of x and y, right? And then we're plugging in our functions of t. So we're taking the derivative of that thing. And that is, in terms of the functions, it would look like this. Partial f, partial x, partial f, partial y. Time, and then the g prime and the h prime, right? So this is how it looks in the fake, fraction notation. And that's how it looks in the functional notation of little primes or subscripts. Either way, you can see it's a dot product again. So if you like that notation better, okay, fine. I don't have a strong preference about the notation. I think generally the functional notation is more precise, but the fake fraction notation is easier to get an intuition about. And even some people want to be even more precise than putting little X's and Y's there. They want to have, well, just first input variable, second input variable, so they use F1 and F2.
questions or comments about this?
Okay, that's the story on why.
Yeah.
You talk to a mathematician, they always want to tell you why, right? They don't just want to tell you how to solve a problem, they want to tell you why it works. Yeah. Hazard of being in the same room as a mathematician.
Right. Okay. This is written in terms of the components. So here's the 2D, let's remember the 2D version. So then, since the gradient is those partial derivatives, then you need partial Q, partial X, to match over there. Right this way. So you need partial Q, partial X to match partial P, partial Y. And 3D... Then you have three things. So I mean, the conclusion of this one is that you need... If this fails, you don't have a gradient, so you can't use this lovely shortcut. Right? 3D, you have three of those.
Test, then F is locally a gradient. So what's that mean? I'll try and say a little bit more about that. It's locally conservative was what we could say in slightly fancier language. The problem is sometimes you can have something where the local niceness of the field doesn't become global. It doesn't work on a global scale. But now for the fundamental theorem of line integrals, this thing again. for this little plug in the endpoints trick to apply. We need F to be the gradient of the same lowercase f over our whole path. And I'll show you how you could have things be nice locally, but go wrong over your whole path. Okay. So here's what I'm going to have. I'm going to have this ray here of this ray is going to be x less than or equal to 0 and y equals 0. So I'm starting at the origin in two-dimensional space, and I'm going to the left forever. Okay, and outside of this ray, if I use the arc cosine formula for getting the polar theta, so how does this work? You take the sine of y times the inverse cosine, arc cosine, inverse cosine, same thing, of x over r. Okay. This guy would be 1 if y is positive, 0 if y is 0, and negative 1 if y is negative. So this is fine, except over here. See, the problem over here is, if I go this way, I get pi radians. If I go this way, I get negative pi radians. And so if you try and define things here, you're either going to pick pi or negative pi on this ray. But whatever you pick, there'll be this nasty discontinuity as you hop from here over to here. Right? So there's discontinuity along this ray, right? Because you have to make this hop from negative pi to pi or pi to negative pi as you go up or down across that bad ray. Right? So outside of that bad ray, if you use this formula, then if you take the gradient of this nasty-looking formula, you can actually simplify it a bunch, okay? And what you get is, I believe you get negative y comma x over x squared plus y squared. So locally, okay. So if we have any little region that avoids that ray.
We have a gradient, right? So let's call this thing, let's call this vector field here F. So if you do an integral inside a good region, so maybe you have some region here, right, that avoids the ray, and then you have some path, right, like this. So I guess maybe the word is in any region avoiding the ray. If you integrate this nasty-looking vector field dot dr, then you will just get theta at the end point minus theta at the start point. So I would just so the integral would be really easy if we saw that we had the gradient of theta, right? We would just have to measure the angle here. We just have to measure the angle there, right? Theta at the end, and then another angle here. This is a negative angle, right? Theta at the start. In this example, this path is going counterclockwise, right? So theta will go from a negative angle at the start, in this case, to a positive angle at the end. So theta increased, right? So everything's good. But if you have an integral that goes through that bad ray, you could be in trouble. And I can demonstrate that. Satisfy the fundamental theorem of line integrals if we go through the bad ray. So let's see an example of that. So this is an example of a function where it's tricky because locally it's good. It passes the cross-partials test and it really is a gradient in any region that at least avoids the bad ray. In fact, you can cook up alternate definitions of theta so that even if you're on the bad ray, you could have a little region there where it was fine. But if you do a path that actually makes a full circle, then somewhere your definition of theta will have this discontinuity. Let's say we just do a very natural thing. Let's say maybe we do a circle of radius 5, right? This will be our path C, all right? So I want to do the integral along C of f dot dr. So I'm going to have what? Well, before we talk about all the parameterizing, let's see. If the fundamental theorem of line integrals applied, uh, then since we're going to start and end at the same point, right? Our start and end position will be right there. We'd have the ending theta minus the starting theta, and I'm going to start there at on the positive x-axis. So I just have 0 minus 0 equals 0. But we're not going to get 0. We're actually going to get 2 pi. And that's because although on any chunk that doesn't go around a full circle, you could cook up a definite, a choice of theta that had that gradient. If you try and define theta all the way around, you always get this discontinuity because of the problem of if you go around a circle like this, you've gone around 360 degrees on the one hand, but on the other hand, you're back where you started, so you must be back at the same theta value. So you have to have some discontinuity somewhere. So let's see how this goes wrong. Okay, so we need to parameterize C. Okay, so have x be the, let's see, radius 5, right? So 5 times the cosine of, say, t be the parameter. Y is 5 times the sine of t. T goes from 0 to 2 pi. Okay, so we integrate from 0 to 2 pi. Now what do I have up there? I have negative y, so negative 5 times the sine of t, comma x, so 5 times the cosine of t. And downstairs I have 5 squared times cosine squared t plus another 5 squared times the sine squared of t. So that term will just become a 1. So there's going to be a ton of cancellation here. And what about the dr, right? So that's your dx dt and your dy dt, right? All times dt. Right? So you're just taking the time derivatives and then multiplying by your time increment. So, okay, dx dt for us would be negative 5 times the sine of t. Dy dt would be 5 times cosine of t. I did my derivatives right. Okay, so. What happens when we take the dot product? I'm going to have this times that.
That'll be 25 sine squared t.
I'm also going to have then added this times that,
25 cosine squared t. So it's actually going to be a big cancellation.
From 0 to 2 pi. We just have a 1 there. 1 over 5 squared. So here we have 5 times 5, but then we have, look, a sine squared t, and then a cosine squared t. All times dt. So it's just going to be another big 1. These cancel. So you're just integrating the change in t, our parameter, from 0 to 2 pi. Okay, so you're just adding up all the little changes as you go from 0 to 2 pi. If you want, yeah, you can write, okay, the antiderivative is t, plug in 2 pi and 0, but
As I think of it, it's just the total change in t, which is 2 pi, right? Not 0. Right? So you can have something that's a gradient locally, meaning on any little piece of your path, you know, you could use the fundamental theorem on any little piece, but it on the full circle, in this case, things go bad. And so you can't just apply the fundamental theorem. You'll get the wrong answer. Okay, so if you pass the cross partials test, then yes, your function is a gradient locally, but there may be some kind of subtle global failure like this. Right? And let's see, 117. Okay, so. So we need to bring up. So that was the tricky example I've been planning to put. Questions or comments about this? I'm going to ask some kind of summary here. Let me kill this. Decision diagram. Cross partials test. Okay. If we fail the cross partials test, don't even try to use the fundamental theorem of line integrals. Do your integral directly. Yesterday. Right? Parameterize your path, do the integral. Right? If you pass, okay, you're still not out of the woods yet. Then we're in a great situation. Right? So, if you have one function whose gradient is your field all along your path, then yay. If not, then parameterize and find the integral directly. Okay, that's the. Okay. So in general, there isn't a shortcut, but. If your field really is the gradient of the same function along the whole path, then you have this nice shortcut. I'm not going to assign any homework today. We need to talk about how to actually find these Fs that are gradients of the good vector fields, and that's what we're going to do tomorrow. Right?